Hi there, and welcome once again to the Fourth Estate. My name's Mick Caldwell. Great to be back as we look ahead for what's on today.
Almost anyone you speak to has got some sort of telco war story these days. The problem is it's run by an industry code called the Telecommunications Consumer Protection Code. So when you go to the Telecommunications Industry Ombudsman or the TIO with a complaint, what they do is they look at your complaint against this code. And I don't mind saying on this program that codes are a pile of shit and they don't work when you've got an industry as large as this one, making as much money as this one. And, you know, there are so many. Everybody has at least one communication service.
As a Fourth Estate first, we offer up a chance to amass an on-air support group for all those people feeling aggrieved by their telcos. Plus, we add a bit of colour to an arguably bland and Anglo cinema world. Plus, we offer up an on-air mass group therapy sessions for any of you out there who have suffered, who have fallen victim to their telco abuse. And trust me, you're not alone out there. And we also face off in the ring between Bob Brown and those calls about media bias. So it's all up and ready to rumble here on the Fourth Estate. I hope you stay tuned. But firstly, as of now, Sydney Metropolitan Radio listeners will have 8 new digital community radio stations to choose from. And it's been a long time coming, with the likes of commercial radio having a digital presence 2 years ago. Such as its television counterpart, it's now possible to have more channels with more content and the ability to pause, rewind and fast forward your favourite program. But just like digital TV, there is that challenge to produce the same high quality new material on what's arguably a fairly limited budget, as Leanne Torpy reports.
I now have the great privilege of declaring Sydney Community Digital Radio officially launched, and wish you all well as you reach out to the beautiful people across our city and beyond. Thank you.
The New South Wales Governor, Her Excellency Marie Bashir, officially launching 8 new digital community radio stations. I'm here at the launch in Darling Harbour, Sydney. With over 150 people, the excitement is palpable. The Community Broadcasting Association of Australia board coordinator of the digital project, Philip Randall, believes the launch has the potential to expand the charter of community radio.
If we look at community radio as being about access and diversity and equity and community, I think it does have the potential to do that. One of the stations here in Sydney, 2000 FM, the ethnic and multicultural station, they're looking to add a whole lot of new languages because they now have additional time to do that.
The guest of honour, the New South Wales Governor, Her Excellency Marie Bashir, acknowledged the crucial role that community radio plays in the Australian media landscape and the role of volunteers in achieving this feat.
It's an awesome statistic to recall that 54% of Australians over 15 listen to community radio, and that there are over 20,000 volunteers supporting these wonderful initiatives. It's helped shape the landscape in Australia in so many ways. Your stations have made and are continuing to make a very, very special contribution to the cultural life of our nation.
At the launch, it was obvious that the tireless efforts of many have made the event possible, directed by the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia. Commercial broadcasters were given a one-to-one ratio of analogue to digital licences back in 2009, but community stations have been given effectively half of that spectrum, and it's only been launched this year. Which means that from today, 8 metropolitan-based Sydney community radio stations will share the digital space. The hope is that the switch-off for analogue TV will provide more space, and the community sector is actively lobbying for more space and more funding. So far, the government has provided funding for infrastructure, and the latest budget provided a $12.5 million boost over 4 years for content programming. But as we've all seen with TV, having more channels doesn't necessarily mean more high-quality programming. And for the under-resourced broadcasting sector, the risk of decreasing quality is real. Philip Randall, CBAA Board Coordinator of the Digital Project.
I think there is a risk that content can be affected. You're now having to work with your community to create 48 hours a day of content. I think the great thing is, though, that from day one you don't have to do that. So a community station really can simulcast for as long as it feels it needs to, while it puts into place the resources, the people resources primarily, and some financial resources, to actually start creating programming specific to community radio.
Now, you mentioned there's no switch-off date. Obviously, this opportunity is being provided to the 8 metro stations in the Sydney area. Thinking about sub-metro stations, what does it mean for them going digital? Is there a chance that sub-metro stations will eventually be shut out of the radio spectrum?
Well, as a sector, we would not want the sub-metro stations to be shut out in any way. There are obviously lots of challenges with using the current digital technology to have suburban sub-metro stations operating. Community radio as a sector is certainly saying sub-metro licensees need to be a part of digital. Of course, then there's the whole issue of regional areas, and there are regional trials happening at the moment in a couple of parts of Australia, in Canberra and I believe in Townsville. In the near future, we would hope to see that there would be legislation in place to enable digital to roll out into the larger regional centres.
So for those of you who have digital radios, listen out for your community radio station. And if you're not based in the metropolitan area, watch this space.
Out on the field to report on the exciting new launch for digital radio in the community broadcasting sector, that was Leanne Torpy reporting. If you'd like to check out some of the pics, they are on the Fourth Estate Radio webpage, which of course is 4thestateradio.blogspot.com. Without the financial considerations of the Faculty of Arts at Macquarie University, as well as the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences at the University of Technology Sydney, well, the Fourth Estate wouldn't be coming to you on your airwaves. So, thanks. During a recent press conference, Greens leader Senator Bob Brown took aim at some of Australia's news media. In a heated exchange with a Fairfax radio journalist, Senator Brown insisted that there is a definite prejudice by the Murdoch press in their reports. In fact, he even went as far as to accuse News Limited of putting out hate media and called for more balance in political reportage. And indeed, ex-Federal Labor Minister Lindsay Tanner has had a fair swipe at the Australian political journalism situation with the release of his new book, Sideshow. Mr. Tanner accuses the media of dumbing down content and being preoccupied with personalities as opposed to issues and policies. So is the Australian news media becoming more opinionated, simplistic and indeed sensational? What pressures are current journalists feeling, and is this leading to a change in the way that our news is reported? Nathan Coates checked in with Dr. Joseph Fernandez. He's a media journalism professor at Curtin University.
Does Bob Brown have a point in his recent attacks on the media, or is he just a politician frustrated with unfavourable news reports?
I think it's a mix of both, and one can debate as to how much of one and how much of the other. He seems to have spoken out in a moment of frustration, and I say that because he used French, as they say, in his recent criticisms of coverage by what he called the hate media. These are all pretty strong terms when you criticize the media. On the other hand, there appears to have been a fairly long-standing, simmering conflict that has been building up between the Australian in particular and the Greens. And I think one of the instances that points to this is the Australians' call for the Greens to be destroyed at the ballot box. One can argue whether that is something that led to Bob Brown's recent outburst. And on the other hand, you can ask whether the Australian, or any other newspaper for that matter, is entitled to take a position as strong as the one that was expressed in...
So on that, the Australian did respond to Senator Brown's commentary. Journalist James Masola reported, part of his report included a quote from his editor-in-chief, Chris Mitchell, saying, "We have long supported a market-based mechanism for dealing with climate change." So in saying that, the Australian has taken a political position, or is saying that they've taken a political position on climate change, is there a problem with news producers taking a position on political issues?
You would like to think that some people would prefer that the media stayed out of it and merely gave them the facts and allowed the consumer to form their own opinions. But there is also plenty of room for advocacy journalism, and by that I mean for newspapers like The Australian to take a stand when issues are very, very significant, when there's a great deal of public concern or public interest in the matter, and climate change, carbon tax is one of those issues that The Australian has decided to take a very strong position on, and there's nothing wrong with that per se. But as long as the competing views, conflicting opinions are not left out or prevented from being aired through their media, then I would say it's okay.
And there's also been Lindsay Tenner's accusation that the media is too focused on personalities and is responsible for dumbing down content. Does a focus on opinion and personalities lead to a dumbing down of content in news reporting?
Not necessarily, but I think we've had a long-standing problem with the media, and a study was done on this more than a decade ago. There is an inadequate emphasis in media coverage on the setting out of the facts. People tend to be very comfortable with expressing opinions without providing an adequate factual foundation for those opinions, and I think that's where the problem really arises. There's no problem, there's no harm in expressing an opinion and even expressing opinions very strongly, but when those strong opinions are expressed without providing the consumer or the audience with the facts upon which you reach those opinions, you're not doing a service to the news-consuming public.
And I'm just wondering, in terms of the emergence of opinion generators, blogs, Twitter, and so on, do you think these media outlets, if you like, are influencing journalists to be more interesting and opinionated in their news reporting?
Yes, I think so. You know, the old filtering processes have been severely undermined by the phenomenal growth in self-publishing through the internet, through the social media, and I think mainstream media is struggling to find a new sense of balance to stay relevant in an environment where people, you know, your every average Joe Blow on the street is now not deprived of the opportunity to give his or her views a venting.
And I'm also wondering if the recently the Fairfax decision to outsource sub-editing created somewhat of a culture of fear, possibly inside the media, causing journalists maybe to toe the line more in terms of editorial policies they might think are biased.
Sure, sure. Employers seem to have greater options at their disposal now find alternatives for journalistic production, and naturally, if you do not have job security, few are the journalists who would be prepared to continue their fearless form of journalism. If you are depending on your career, on your job, it's your bread and butter, and employers have convenient alternatives at their disposal, cheaper alternatives, this potentially has a very serious chilling effect on fearless journalism.
Curtin University's Dr. Joseph Fernandez speaking there to Nathan Coates for the Fourth Estate. And don't forget, if you liked that story or indeed anything we play here on the show, it's yours. Just head along to 4thestateradio.blogspot.com. And while the notion of fairness, balance and objectivity is certainly not lost on the likes of Team 4th Estate, this next story is certainly one that is true to my own heart, as I have just faced off in what has turned out to be a 6-month battle with my ex-telecommunications provider, and it turns out that I'm not alone. ACMA last year began a campaign entitled Reconnecting the Customer. Ever since 1997, telcos have been self-regulated at what was arguably the crest of a huge tidal wave in advances in digital communications. And with the national broadband network struggles that already stand in the way, we as the customers have ultimately been the ones to suffer under the hands of this deregulation experiment. One group in particular has been trying to keep those bastards honest. The Australian Communications Consumer Action Network was singled out specifically by ACMA Chairman Chris Chapman in its efforts to protect the rights of so many aggrieved customers such as myself. And now joining me is Elise Davidson.
We're the consumer advocate. Almost anyone you speak to has got some sort of telco war story these days.
ACMA are to publish on Wednesday the findings from reconnecting the customer. Now, what's going to be pinpointed here?
So we're waiting on this with bated breath. We'll definitely be waking up in the morning like it's Christmas, wondering what's under the tree. What we're expecting is the ACMA to come out and have their findings of this inquiry, which included people making submissions. They've released research and draft papers. They've had public hearings, so yep. Aggrieved telco customers could actually go in and say to the regulator, can you please do something? And when they hand down this bundle of information as a report, they'll be making recommendations about the best way forward for regulation of the industry, because at the moment the current self-regulatory system can't be enforced. What I mean is they'll put in place standards, so it might be a customer service standard or it might be a complaint handling standard across the industry to deal with just the real basics, which the telcos can't seem to get right.
Recently, I heard you hitting on what seems to be a bit of a universal problem, that no one knows what is happening once you're logged in, and that the tracking data usage has become almost impossible, so that these figures just kind of come out of nowhere.
Yeah, absolutely. The latest rise of bill shock, and there have been many incarnation, is about excess data charges on smartphones. They'll offer these products and services with really attractive upfront marketing deals, value which no one can understand because it's not clearly laid out in terms of how much data you do get, what sort of phone, how much data it uses up, and hey presto, people are getting caught out with these really high excess data charges when they go over the limit. Even those who try to stay within their limits find it hard to monitor their data usage because they don't have real-time tracking tools.
What do you think was behind the idea that they shouldn't be regulated?
So it used to be owned by the government. They thought, okay, we can make some money off of this. We'll sell it. We'll open up the market, bring in competition. Economists will like to say that competition fixes these sort of problems in terms of self-regulation, and that the industry does self-regulate because those who are offering the best products and services will get the most business and force others to change or else die. Unfortunately, what we've seen with the telco industry since that time is a rapid increase in the type of technologies that we're using. They're more complicated products, and we really want the telcos to drop that in the first instance.
Why don't you fill out a form? We can't get back to you, of course we can't get back to you, but rest assured we'll take your comments on board. Your thoughts may change.
Geography really dictates your phone. Some of the cheaper ones will ultimately consider the boonies anywhere out of a metropolitan CBD.
Yep.
So I think that that's also been really quite, that really does dictate a lot in Australia.
Absolutely.
And now the NBN's rolling out across the country. We know this amazingly exorbitant price tag, and yet it seems that no one's really keen to jump on board with most of the telcos who are getting that stuff happening. And on the brink of such, as I say, this amazing time of of the really unknown advances.
We'll certainly be interested to see, first of all, what the ACMA decide. It's something that we refer to as a perfect storm because TCP, the Telecommunications Consumer Protection Code, right now, they've had this massive inquiry going on with the regulator right now, and they're also looking at the TIO system, so the ombudsman system. So we've got sort of all three stars aligned, if you will, and the government knows, and also the regulator knows, that they've got to get this right before the NBN happens, and we're getting multiple services over the NBNs. What we've been trying to do at ACAN is let people know what is going on, because we have a better idea than most working in this area. And the National Broadband Network, the thing that we're most excited about that coming out, is the fact that it talks about those issues that you were talking about, Meg. If you live in a regional area, you pay more to get a lot less. And the National Broadband Network is going to be a level the playing field.
We can't get back to you, of course we can't get back to you, but rest assured we'll take your comments on board. Your thoughts make me dead.
Am I one of the lucky ones, though, in the fact that I've now finally freed myself of these shackles of hundreds of dollars of debt? Are people, in the end, are the telcos owning up and facing responsibility to the customers, do you think?
Look, they know they have to lift their game, whether or not they have the ability to, the systems in place, the training for their staff, all that sort of thing is another matter entirely. In terms of are you one of the lucky ones, I'd say probably you're actually one of the ones that persevere. And the problem is it's kind of like a war of attrition. The telcos wear you down. We did some research last year with Galaxy Research that found only 7% of people that had had a problem in the past 12 months had gone to the ombudsman. The 200,000 or so complaints that they get every year, that's only 7% of the people that are actually having a problem. So we know that there's a lot of people that just give up before because they haven't heard of the TIO, they think it's too hard, or they're simply just worn down.
Let's spend some time together. We'll save you money.
Now in its second year, the Colourfest Film Festival is offering an opportunity for bored film goers to enjoy a more culturally diverse perspective through the cinema lens. This year, the festival director, Gary Paramanathan, is taking the event across the East Coast, touring from Marrickville's Red Rattler Theatre to the likes of Melbourne and Brisbane. Kim Tan caught up with Gary.
So Gary, you're the director of Colourfest, but I've also read that you co-directed and founded it.
Yes.
What is the truth?
So I started Colourfest last year. I had this idea. I made a film for Troughfest and it got shortlisted as in the top 60, but didn't make it to the final 16.
Was that Dime?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was played in Shortcuts last year. And a friend of mine, Fatima Mawas, made a film and she also got shortlisted but didn't make it to the top 16. And I knew a couple of other people who made films for Troughfest that didn't make it in. I just thought, you know what, like, I really like these films. I want to just screen them somewhere. So I decided to have kind of an anti-Troughfest film festival screening these films that didn't get in and I think that deserve to get in. From there, it kind of evolved to this idea of a festival that would be about cultural diversity, because all my friends who made these films were from culturally diverse backgrounds and were telling stories about culturally diverse people, I guess. Yeah, so I set up the festival and we called it Colourfest. Did it last year with my friend Joey Hakim, who's now in LA studying film. So I'm doing it alone this year, flying solo. But I have a lot of support. I have Saber Baluch, who's a production manager for me, and a couple other really good volunteers on board as well, including Jackie Leeway.
Okay, so your other job is as the coordinator for Switch. Would you like to explain Switch?
So Switch is part of Information Cultural Exchange, which is, a community arts organisation in Parramatta. And we kind of work with the Western Sydney Basin, so from Parramatta to Fairfield to Liverpool to Auburn to Blacktown to Penrith. Mm-hmm. And we work mainly with emerging communities, so migrants and refugees and some Indigenous communities, mm-hmm. in essentially telling their stories, so either through film or music or design or any sort of digital artistic form of expression to tell their stories by running workshops and mentorship and things like that. So.
Okay. And does the Switch role and the Colourfest role combine?
Yeah, totally. I think, I mean, I'm really surprised that no one else came up with an idea for Colourfest. Like, it's so obvious that you need to have a film festival that acknowledges and shows, you know, stories of cultural diversity in Australia, because we are essentially a country built on migration, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason my idea became a reality is because I had the networks, the support of people that I work with and other organizations that I partner with. So I got the opportunity to soundboard my ideas and kind of get them off the ground. And of course, you know, I work with Muna, Zayla and Fadi Aboud, who are the co-directors of the Arab Film Festival. So they've been amazingly helpful and I guess essentially been my mentors in me getting up this festival.
I've noticed that Colourfest is promoted on Twitter, and you guys are also on YouTube and Facebook. Am I missing any other social media?
No, I think they're the big three, right?
Yes, they are. Which out of the big three, in your opinion, is the most successful for promoting Colourfest?
For me, I think it depends on the individual, right? Like, I love Facebook. I think I'm on Facebook like 200 times a day. My colleagues are like, they make fun of me for the amount of time I spend on Facebook. And for me, that's given me sort of like, I know how to deal with Facebook and I know how to set up events and a page and a group and how to get people to come along to stuff. Twitter, I'm quite new to, so I always like, I don't know what to say. You know what I mean? How you have to tweet on a regular basis.
Mm, it's 140 characters.
Yeah, 140 characters, and you have to like tweet based on who, like this, you know, who and what is Colourfest. And sometimes I just want to say really random things and I'm like, no, you can't say that. Whereas with Facebook, I think you can kind of, you can be Gary, you know, Paramanathan and still run the Colourfest page sort of thing. And YouTube is just a great place, I mean, to visualize your ideas, I guess, you know, like put together videos and stuff. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the first year for Colourfest was last year, so the Genesis year. What have you learned since then?
You know, the first year was incredibly easy and smooth. It's only the second year I'm finding is a really big learning curve and a really good experience for me, because last year we just did it at the Red Rattler Theatre in Marrickville, and it was a very, so two sessions. It was a small event. We sold out opening night, and closing night was, you know, had half capacity, so I was really happy with that. But it was a small event and it was easy to manage. But this year we're going to Brisbane and Melbourne, and this year we're playing in two locations in Sydney, at Red Rattler and Riverside. And I've learned just really new things, like apparently before you have a film festival you need to have a classification exemption from the classification board. Last year I didn't have to get it. This year I got an email from one of the venues saying, if you do not get the exemption, we will not screen your films because it's illegal. So I was like, what? So I had to make
Margaret Pomeranz, actually. Maybe you'll get a huge attendance, like fill up Balmain Town Hall.
Yeah. Exactly. Have a protest screening. So yeah, I'm learning that, and a few other things, like, you know, just I'm learning a lot about marketing and distributing things like postcards and posters and trying to figure out how people get interested in coming to festivals, like what works and what doesn't.
Okay, so you've got your shortlist.
The finalists are actually already out.
Oh, great.
So there's two sessions, and so there's 17 films screening, and out of the 17 films, seven of them are finalists. And yeah, so it's already on the website, mm-hmm. and it's already with the judges already, actually. So on the 4th of June is the Riverside event, the main event, where we'll announce the winners.
What's the best feedback that you've had so far for Colourfest?
The best feedback? Well, I mean, it's really interesting, the whole idea of cultural diversity and telling stories about culturally diverse communities is who has the right to tell the stories? You know, if you're a Southeast Asian filmmaker who grew up in Australia, are you allowed to, or can you tell the story of, say, an African refugee? Or should a person of African background and, you know, who's kind of lived and experienced that or has some association to that, tell that story? And so those sort of questions I'm starting to kind of ponder these days, because you kind of wonder, you know, like sharing culturally diverse stories, it's not just about getting that actor and getting that story, but it's also empowering the people who've lived that to tell that story. So to allow them to be the writer, the director, the producers, so they feel like they have some ownership over all these stories.
Kim Tan, speaking with Gary Paramanathan, the director of Colourfest. And that's all we have time for here on the Fourth Estate. Don't forget to check out the podcast, which is 4thstate.podomatic.com. So until next week, I'm Nick Caldwell.